So I'll just start by saying this is Rosemary Hall recording on behalf of the Dialect and Heritage Project, the University of Leeds. It's Wednesday the 7th of September 2022. And could I ask you please to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Michael Brennan. I'm Professor of Renaissance Studies at the School of English, University of Leeds.
And what's your connection with the Survey of English Dialects?
My connection is with Stanley Ellis rather than the survey, because I came to Leeds in September 1984. And I was allocated a room in 9 Cavendish Road, across the road from the main building. And I think it was the second day I was there, there was a knock on the door. And who was it but Stanley? And he came in and introduced himself, which was very nice of him, and we had a chat. And then he also mentioned at the end that he had used his office phone number for people contacting him about various dialect talks or media events, and would I possibly mind passing on his home address since he'd now retired, which I was very happy to do. So I would say for a good year or so, I occupied the unofficial role of Stanley's booking secretary, which was very amusing because it was predominantly, I remember the Police Benevolent Society, the Fire Brigade, I think local history and people interested in dialect, and then some people who simply rang up and asked for Stanley, and I explained he'd retired, so gave them the number, and I never quite knew who they were. So that was how I first met him. But he then tended, when occasionally he was on campus, even though he was retired, he'd call in, and we got to know each other reasonably well, actually, because he was just such good company, and we did have quite a lot of interests in common.
What was he like?
He was very friendly. He was very interested, always I noticed, in what you had to say, and he always had something that could follow that up. We talked, for example, I'm originally from Liverpool, although I don't have much of a Liverpool accent now, and I lived down south for quite a long time, but how to pick up certain phrases and words, and particularly vowel use in Liverpool, the double O in the middle, where you might actually read a kook book, and so on. And it was interesting, and I think I heard from other people that when he was a lecturer, one of his lectures, which I think was a very popular one, he used to actually have students read a short script, and he would talk to them about where he felt their dialect had been formed, or their accent had been formed, which was not necessarily, of course, where they were then from. And subjects like that took us on to, I had a student who had a very faint Australian accent, I remember, and I remember talking to her about that, and where are you from? And I think it was something like Basingstoke. So I said, how's that? And she said, oh, my family did emigrate, but we only stayed about 9 months. And none of my brothers and sisters have an accent, but for some reason I picked it up. And I think talking to Stanley about that, he was telling me about there's a very certain age for a child. I think we talked about sort of 3 to 4, where accents and intonations can be picked up. And this girl, although she was obviously 18, 19, 20, still had that kind of tone to it. So we always had things to talk about, and particularly Yorkshire dialect, because although I was from Liverpool, my mother had always spent her childhood in the summer with family friends in Grassington. And by very strange chance in the 1960s, my father met the then elderly lady who she used to stay with. So the family connection resumed, and we used to go over once or twice a year, or perhaps even more. And we talked about the Yorkshire dialect and Stanley's recordings. And then we got on to, I loved hearing about his time on his motorbike with his sidecar. And then his promotion when he got married, I think he got a Land Rover and a caravan. And he and his wife went round all over the country recording people, which I never quite asked him what his wife really thought about that. But I like the image of Stanley as this kind of gypsy vernacular collector.
Well, then, any particular stories of fieldwork that he shared with you?
He liked, I think, particularly when I talked to him, telling me about people from an agricultural background. And he, in some ways, I got the sense he felt very at home there. And I know he liked talking to them about their work and their daily life and the animals. And I think that was very interesting. So we used to talk, obviously not always about dialect and language, as many other things. I remember talking to Stanley about painting his house when it was summer and he was starting at 6 a.m. before the heat got too much and was up ladders. This is when he was well in his late 70s, I think. But also about urban language, because I, as I say, from Liverpool, so I was interested in the mixed communities there, that there was a very good bookshop, a second-hand bookshop in Liverpool that was very close to the China region, the China Quarter. And I used to really like that, particularly at festival times, and how even the kind of permutation of language from the docks would come into people's daily use. So that was very interesting. So we talked about agricultural things, but also about how cities developed totally different kinds of vernacular use because of the incredible mix of people. And my father was a customs and excise man, and I knew the docks very well and used to often be down with him there. And just hearing the intonations, I was always fascinated by West Indian Caribbean accent, particularly Jamaican accents. And talking to Stanley about that, even though he was obviously focused on really the British Isles. So he was just someone very easy to talk to and very interested in, I would say, global language rather than just English or British dialects.
And what year would it have been when you took over his old office?
It was 1984.
Okay.
So I knew him probably right up to, did he die about 2009, something like that? I probably saw him 2008 or 2007. So we often used to come across each other, and occasionally I remember meeting him, say, in the Harewood Arms in Harewood, and, you know, not planned, but we just come across each other. And he was the kind of person that when you met Stanley and walked into a bar, he would be sitting with people. You started the conversation as you were actually getting a drink, and then you'd join them. It was just a natural process that he did have a sort of very welcoming, you'd almost say magnetic appeal to people to talk to, which must have made his skill in doing the job he did in the vernacular project perfect. Because he was the kind of person, I think, could talk to all different kinds of people on a very immediate level. You didn't get to know Stanley. You almost started talking to him straight away.
How long were you in that office?
I was probably in there about 10 years. And then I moved office. But you know, we still sort of, you know, met each other. And we never kept in touch in a particularly ordered or, you know, planned way. It was just we'd come across each other. And you know, it was always interesting to have a chat with him. It could be 5 minutes, it could be, you know, just sitting and have a cup of tea or coffee or something like that. But it was the conversation really with Stanley.
Yeah. Can you tell me a bit more about the sort of inquiries you would get on the phone?
Yeah, they were they still stick in my mind vividly, and I think probably I made perhaps a little too much of the differences, but I always remember people who were retired firemen, presumably, ringing up. And they were always very genial to talk to. They wanted to know how Stanley was and to take the number. And one or two of them I got to know just in a verbal sense over the phone. Then I must have spoken to them three or four times. And that was usually a sort of little chat as well. And then the police benevolent front would always ring. And again, I got to know the organised. But I always remember the first time I was rung that could I speak to Stanley? And the person had obviously recognised this was not the voice he was used to. And I explained that Stanley had retired and I'd taken over his room. But he'd asked me to pass on a phone number, which he took down. And he then thanked me at the end of it. And then, and could I take your name again, please? And I always felt that being a good police officer, he was just going to check I hadn't sort of taken Stanley hostage or kidnapped him. And, you know, that sense of, you know, who is this person? And, you know, as any policeman would, you want to know, who am I speaking to? And I was not expecting to speak to you on this phone number. And then others would just ring up very briefly and, you know, explain they were from a particular local society or history society and pass on the numbers. And then one or two people, simply, could I speak to Stanley Ellis? So he's now retired. Thank you for the number. And that was it. So it was quite fun, really, because they used to ring towards the end of the day, usually. I think that was the habit with Stanley, sort of before he went home in the evening. And was when I first moved in, I was quite new and I was living in lodgings, and I used to sort of, you know, come in early and go home late. So being Sandy's booking secretary fitted in perfectly.
Can you explain why those different groups of people were calling Stanley?
He was giving talks, I think, after dinner talks or society talks. Once I was here, I'd sometimes switch the radio on and whose voice it was, but Stanley's voice. And he was a natural sort of communicator, and he was a natural raconteur about his experiences in recording. So I think he would do the same thing in probably after dinner speaking or local societies. But I remember the Benevolent Funds used to, I think, like his presence. And then, of course, with the Yorkshire Ripper and Stanley's involvement in that, and identifying the hoaxer tape of Wearside Jack, he was a very well-known person at that point in, I would say, Yorkshire, but probably more broadly as well. And I got the sense, I never quite knew where these people were ringing from. It wasn't just local Leeds Fire Brigade, Benevolent Fund, Police Benevolent Fund, or local history societies. It was much broader than that. And I think when he retired, he was still a relatively young man and very, very fit. So I think it must have been quite enjoyable for Stanley to go off and meet people in other parts to give them talks. And I'm sure, I'd love to have been at them actually, I'm sure he could have, for example, gone to Kent and told Kentish people all about their own accents and how he would identify them and things like that. So I think it was, he was a great entertainer as a speaker, but who isn't interested in how people communicate, how people speak? That's what it's all about, really. And people are always interested in the development of their own, not just accents, but also their own language and their own uses of words.
Do you have a memory of how that Wearside Jack case evolved? Did you follow it at the time?
I did, very much, yeah. I remember it. I was not in Leeds at the time. I was down south at university and then working down south, but it was a national thing, and having a sister from school time, where lots of people had sisters at the local schools, we'd always had a really big male-female schoolboy, schoolgirl community we knew, and we used to meet up, we'd long since left school, but the group of people kept together, and I always remember it was just a natural system that no girl went home on her own. And this was in Liverpool. But the sense of the danger permeated it. And I remember the flurry of young women taking driving tests and talking to a few of them saying, I really felt I wasn't very good, but I also got the sense I wasn't going to fail short of crashing, and the need to actually get people secure. So it was a pretty daunting, terrifying time. And then obviously, being so focused on Leeds, it was a very tragic event. But the thing interesting talking to Stanley about the Wearside Jack tape is that clearly a hoaxer, and that came out to be very close to where he'd identified the accent, I think in the Washington area or whatever, I'm not an expert in that. But I remember him saying that I never said that this is the Yorkshire Ripper. I was asked to actually do a specific job in identifying an accent, and he never went into great detail and said I knew it wasn't the Yorkshire Ripper, but he was clearly very, very sceptical. And it was interesting, I wish I'd almost talked to him more about it, because I got the sense that he felt that what the person was saying was a dramatic act in his own accent, which it clearly turned out to be when the hoaxer was finally tracked down and identified and prosecuted. But there was a strong sense of scepticism, and I think clearly, tragically, the focus on that tape caused the loss of more lives. So it was a very daunting period, and when I first came to Leeds, I took a room in a lady's house with another student, and she always let out rooms to, I remember, university and police. I suppose because we were relatively respectable and secure people, and that worked well. But she had actually come across Peter Sutcliffe. He was working as a delivery driver at the firm she worked with. So she had seen him, and other people around knew who he was. He was not an unknown figure. And so that was interesting in a rather grim way, because the impact on applications to the School of English, of which there's a very strong female cohort, I think lasted well into the 90s. I was admissions tutor in the early 90s, and I remember looking at the statistical number of applications, and we'd gone down very, very significantly, I think, and by the mid-90s we were really pulling up to being one of the most popular schools again. But it had such a major impact on, you know, something like the study of English at Leeds University.
Michael, can you tell me a bit more about what it felt like to take over Stanley's room?
It was very enjoyable, really. I mean, when you first come to a new city, I think I'd been to Leeds once or twice. I had a friend at university who lived near Wakefield, so we'd occasionally come into Leeds, but I knew nothing about really the university. I didn't know much more than the city centre, and I didn't know that very well. So, as I say, I was living in lodgings, and then I bought a house that was in, I would say, to put it mildly, a rather poor state. And my landlady, who I mentioned, who was a very kind person, and I kept in touch right until her death just over a year ago, so it was in her late 90s. But I remember she came around looking at houses for me, and she looked at this, and she had a broad Yorkshire accent, which I can't imitate, and I wouldn't attempt to imitate, but she said, "Oh, it's a mess, total mess. You should buy it, though. You could do this up." And I stayed on longer than I intended, because I did up the bathroom, one small, you'd say, box room bedroom, and partly did up the kitchen, but I didn't tend to want to cook much in there at the time, and then was gradually building up the house. So I was in the office quite a lot, and I suppose Stanley knew he'd find me there and was still coming in doing things. So he used to, we didn't tend to meet, "Oh, we must go and have a coffee or a drink." We just sat in my room and we talked, really, which I suppose was Stanley's room as well. And I got the sense he was very used to talking in that room, as I'm sure he would have done with his students and people he was working with. So it became a kind of stop-off point for Stanley, really, which I enjoyed. And, you know, he, as I say, he was just very good company and very interesting to talk to.
Can you describe what the room was like?
It was a relatively small room, quite a more rectangular shape. There was a desk by the window. The heating now is much improved, but when I first moved in winter, it had gas fire radiators, and it was absolutely perishingly cold, which I can't say I minded, really. But I remember about, it must have been January, a new cleaner started, and she took it upon herself to put on all the radiators. So she got lots of late boxes of chocolate Christmas presents for that from people, because you come into this sort of warm room and thinking that you'd actually have to turn the heating down, which was a novelty. But it was a sort of, it was right on the end of the terrace, and it's where a lot of people walked up, particularly if they were coming in from the station and so on. So it was a good stopping off point, really.
So it was building 7, you said?
Building 9. At the very end.
And which number was the room? Did it have a number?
It was the one on the ground floor on the right.
Okay.
I'd have to go and look at it now. It's still there, so we could check the number. But it was very easy to get to, really.
Yeah. What stage of your career were you at that time?
That was my first full-time post as a lecturer. I'd had a research fellowship, and then I came up to Leeds. So it was my, you know, I was new to that. I had done a fair bit of teaching and lecturing as a research student and as a research fellow, which I enjoyed, so it wasn't as if any of that was new to me, but Leeds itself was new. But I really enjoyed it, and I got to know it very well, and particularly the M62, since my family were all in Liverpool as well. So it was, you know, an easy point to move to, so to speak, for sort of family reasons.
We've been, at the end of interviews, Michael, we've been talking to people a little bit about their own dialect story. Do you mind telling me a bit about yours?
I'm not sure I really have a dialect story. I remember talking to Stanley, though, that I never had a very strong Liverpool accent. My mother was born and raised in Liverpool, in Everton, but didn't have a strong accent. But I was interested in, my father was from Salford, and her father, although born in Liverpool, had been orphaned at quite an early age and had been taken up to Scotland because he was actually a choir boy and had a very good voice. And he'd been taken by, in fact, the Marquess of Bute to the Isle of Rothesay, where he was a chorister. And he came back, again, this I talked to Stanley about this, because he'd been I presume a boy soprano or whatever, but he came back with a Scottish accent, and his name was Herbert, but he was always known as Jock, both to his wife, who obviously he met later, but also to my mother and her brother and all his people that he worked with. So I must have been in my teens before I discovered his name was actually Herbert. And I was interested in why he would still have retained just Scottish nuances, and why didn't I have a strong Liverpool accent, even though I could imitate the Liverpool accent quite well. And we talked about how, I suppose it's city, and the point I've already mentioned, that urban environments blend people together so much. And I know the Manchester accent quite well because of my father. My wife's from Manchester. But the sense of why some of my classmates who live quite close by me had much stronger accents than I did. And equally, I live down south, but I don't think I developed a particularly southern accent either. And some people never change, while some people gradually adopt the region they're in. So we talked about that, and I don't think we ever came to firm conclusions, really. And that was something that I'm not sure Stanley had a particular line on, of how language develops once you're past the very young age.
Do you have any Liverpool words that you use?
Not in terms of general conversation, but I suppose in terms of, it's interesting how your language would change, although I'm not a particular supporter of either Liverpool or Everton. I know a great deal about Liverpool football and Manchester football, and I think the language sometimes shifts there. And in some ways, today, Stephen Gerrard, Jamie Carragher are very recognisable Liverpool ex-players and pundits or managers. Gary Neville as a Manchester speaker. Roy Keane, of course, as an Irish speaker. So it's more that sense of how people use language in certain areas. I mean, football's a very interesting area in the terms of the use of language. And I had a student from Manchester who always came in to tell us about, and the group just became fascinated by football chants. And he was a Man City supporter, but he started collecting them for us. And I think we were actually studying Renaissance literature at the time, so this was merely an indulgence. But we used to wait for Danny to arrive, I remember his name, to see what chant he would teach the seminar group, which was sort of 3 or 4 minutes before we started discussing Christopher Marlowe or Shakespeare's Hamlet or whatever it was. So there was always that kind of interest, I think.
Do you think you might have picked up any accent or vocabulary in Leeds or Yorkshire generally?
I recognise the Leeds accent, which is very, very strong. And in some ways it was quite different to the Grassington accent, which I knew, which was more rural. I don't think I tend to pick up words in that way, although I probably understand much more. And I know, for example, there's lots and lots of programmes on late at night about cameras following police round, police interceptors and things like this. And they're from different regions of the country, but largely northern. And it's really interesting to watch the West Yorkshire police or the police from the North East, and you hear the real strength of the accent. And that's quite immediate, I think, to pick up. And I can probably switch those programmes on and know which police force it is from the way that the officers are actually speaking. And I suspect Stanley would have been the expert on that, that he could have placed exactly which part of Wearside or Washington or whichever it was. And for that matter, I think talking to him about the difference between Liverpool accent, Birkenhead accent, Wirral accent, what you might describe colloquially as posh Cheshire accent, but still has strong Liverpool intonations. And that was really interesting to see how you could differentiate once you actually got, I suppose, your ear in. And I suppose what I'm saying is I wish I'd really taken whatever module Stanley was teaching, because we didn't overlap. I was never a student. So, and my training in English language was sort of very, very traditional and formal, and I sort of snoozed my way through lectures on phonetics and woke up for things like the history of the English language and the history of dictionaries I found quite interesting. But I was just very surprised when I met Stanley, having had such little, I think, stimulation from my probably not very large exposure to academic study of language, to then suddenly go into this vernacular world where, you know, it really actually was vibrant and vital and interesting to talk about.
Wonderful. Well, Michael, thank you so much for your time. It's been a real privilege.
Pleasure.